This is Richard A. Ernie, field representative of the State Historical Society of Wisconsin, recording the history of Wild Rose as seen and studied by Mr. Robert R. Jones.
I'll begin my reminiscences with tradition. Hearsay evidence it is, maybe, but it may be worth preserving nonetheless. My father, Huey Jones, was 6 years old when he came to this community from Waterville, near Waukesha. He was nearly 87 when he died about 12 years ago. So much of this information is recollections of what he informed me. My grandfather, whose name was the same as mine, Robert R. Jones, was the youngest of eight sons. In Great Britain, a younger son's prospects are not good, so many of the younger sons emigrated. About 10 years ago, I had a talk with Reverend Williams, the then pastor of the Southside Welsh Presbyterian Church of Chicago. He was a very old man at that time, close to 90 or over. He told me that in his childhood, as a child of 6 or 7, he knew my great-grandfather, Richard Jones, of Trefnant Ddu. That was in Wales, Anglesey, when he had an accident thrown off from a horse, and my great-grandfather had rescued him. Trefnant Ddu was a large farmer estate in Anglesey. I don't know precisely how it should be defined. It was, in any case, a few miles from the place that has such a long name, usually called in Welsh circles Llanfair PG. Its full name is Llanfair Pwllgwyngyll Gogerwch Wynrobwy Llantysilio Gogogwch. My grandfather's sister, Mrs. Rowlands, had crossed over somewhat earlier with her husband, and they had settled in Genesee, Wisconsin. And it was that factor that led my grandfather to come to Wisconsin and settle near his sister. At about the same time, the settlement of what later became Washera County started. The settlement around here was referred to in Welsh circles as the Indian Land Settlement because the land had only very recently been bought from the Indians. And my grandfather heard about good prospects here, so he came up and looked the ground over. He found a settler who wanted to sell out, and he bought what that settler had. It was what later became the John Evans farm, and most of what later became the Frank Dopp farm. It's described as the south half, the northeast quarter of Section 1, Township 20, north, Range 10, east, and the south half of the southwest half of the west half of the northwest quarter of Section 7, Township 20, Range 11, east. The house was located near where the Frank Dopp house later stood, practically the precise site for that matter. A little later, he bought the 140-acre farm of the Edwards family to the south and east of his original property. This later on became the family farm, as it was a part of the estate left by my grandfather that my father inherited. The northern part of his land, however, including the first house that he had occupied, had been sold to Frank Dopp. I may mention, incidentally, that I have recollections of that old house. I remember it was a story and a half type, and that in one of the upstairs, two of the upstairs rooms shared one window between them. The partition came right in the middle of the window. It was of frame construction, if I remember right, but I was only a boy of about 5 at the time, so my recollection may not be straight, but I do remember it was very definitely of the pioneer type. My grandmother was a sister of Hugh Elias, who lived near Waukesha. He was rather prominent in Welsh-American circles, having been one of the 3 founders of the Welsh Calvinistic Methodist Church of America. And it was after him that my father had been named. The founding of that church, incidentally, was by 2 elders, of which my great uncle was one, and 1 pastor. All the ordained people that had come over from Wales that the search that was made of the Welsh settlements could locate, and they got together, held a prayer meeting, and decided to start a church organization, managed to get it acknowledged by the Welsh Calvinistic Methodist Church overseas at Wales, and promptly started ordaining pastors and getting the churches started. But the record of that appears in a book written by Dr. Daniel Jenkins Williams, 100 Years of Welsh Calvinistic Methodism in America. This book covers the earlier history of the Welsh Calvinistic churches in this locality as well as elsewhere. In the Welsh settlement here, there were also other Welsh churches. There was a Welsh Congregational Church whose building later became the Springwater Town Hall. It's now serving that purpose. And there was also the Ebenezer Welsh Baptist Church, which has been torn down. I don't have much personal recollection of either one. The earliest I remember of church services was attending the Carsalam Welsh Calvinistic Methodist Church during the long pastorate of Reverend Daniel Thomas. The services at first were always in the Welsh language. The use of Welsh ended during the First World War. I remember a discussion of the matter at that time. One of the elders of the church, Ellis Roberts, spoke very strongly in favor of a change to the use of the English language exclusively. I remember his talk especially because his English had a very, very strong Welsh flavor. English had been used as an optional language, and some of the services had been in English, however, for some time before that. My Sunday school class had turned to English because of a known Welsh cheesemaker who had begun to attend the class. Religious services were longer then, and there were more of them, and the church had a great deal more influence upon its members in such matters as Sunday observance than is usual now. First, there came either the sermon or the Sunday school. That varied from time to time as to which came first, as the church chaired pastors with the Horeb Church at Wild Rose. The pastor preached in one place in the morning and at the other in the afternoon. The Sunday school meeting was long, covering the same time now covered by Sunday school and sermon. The first part of the Sunday school was much like what they have now. It was studying the scripture lesson, but Bibles instead of lesson books were used. Many of those attending Sunday school had biblical commentaries at home, and they made good use of them in preparing the lesson. Next came the meetings, as far as younger people were concerned at least, in the back room. There, the books called The Mother's Gift and The Father's Gift in Welsh, The Rhodd Mam and The Rhodd Tad, were the texts studied. These books were the Welsh equivalents of the Presbyterian longer and shorter catechisms. Everyone was expected to memorize the answers of the scripture texts given in support. The sermons tended to be long, and there was a good choir and a rather large amount of singing, and at times, when there was an election, a very definite rivalry as to who was going to be elected to lead singing. I remember one such rivalry led to the defeated candidate's withdrawal from the church. The singing was taken pretty seriously. However, while the choir sometimes sang numbers, they very rarely had special numbers such as solos, duets, and so forth. Many of the people in earlier times had carried lunches to church, and they remained there between meetings. This was because that many of them in the old days had walked to church, some for considerable distances, and others had teams. Some still carried their lunches to church during the times that I recollect. But behind the church was a long row of horse sheds where the horses and buggies of those attending were sheltered. Some of these sheds had feed boxes in them. They were put in the case of the ones who were who expected to stay over sometimes so that they could feed their horses during the dinner hour. And others didn't have the boxes. Later on, after the Carsalem Church merged with the Horeb Church at Wild Rose, the sheds were moved and they were set up behind the Horeb Church. But even then, cars had begun to replace horses, and the sheds were not much used. They were removed in a few years afterwards. The two churches were a little bit more than a mile apart. This made some difference when they walked to church or when horses were used. But with cars, there simply wasn't any sufficient reason for keeping the two churches going. Now, in the evening, they sometimes had prayer meetings, sometimes young people's Christian Endeavor meetings, and sometimes singing schools. The Saturday afternoon meeting of the organization called class meeting, or in Welsh, the siat. The word siat is a sort of Welshified addition deriving from the word society, I understand, but siat was a name which was very much used nonetheless. It was an important matter. The older people as well as young people attended. The boys and the girls, I remember, were lined up along the wall, and it was a long line, I remember, with perhaps 20 or more attending, and the pastor, or sometimes one of the elders, walked along the line from one to the other, asking each one what scripture verses he had memorized during the week, and each one recited what he had learned. The verses were then briefly discussed by whoever it was that was doing the questioning. There was some rivalry as to who would learn the most verses, and sometimes one of the group would ring in a verse or two that he had used some time before. This was frowned upon, but it was accepted as better than no verse at all. Then, after the verses were finished, the questioner would go down the line again and ask about hymns that had been memorized. I still remember a good many of the old Welsh hymns in Welsh that was learned in that way. The older people then were each called on for comments in line with religious matters. These were something like testimonials. Now we find now, in connection with the church work of the Dutch Reformed Church, they still have an institution very closely related to the Wellsiat. I found that out when I was teaching at Sioux Falls College, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 3 years ago. Now, the Welsh churches in general carried on their missionary work through the Bible Society, and there are records yet of the, I have some of them, of the Bible Society listing who it was that donated how much to the cause over the years. Now, there was also other meetings. Of course, midweek prayer meetings were popular and well attended, and also literary society meetings. Now, the literary society was pretty much the precursor of the modern grange, although they had granges too. They had, in fact, a grange at Wild Rose that was operating, I don't know precisely between what years, but it in general was very similar to the, the literary society was very similar to the modern community club. They had debates, singing, numbers, and that sort of thing. Now, there was also the Good Templars organization, which was strongly in favor of prohibition. The Welsh as a group were strongly dry in their principles, although there were a few of them that were not particularly so in their conduct. And I happen to have somewhere here an old ritual book in the Welsh language of the Good Templars. They did carry on Good Templars' work in the Welsh language as well as the English. The Good Templars organization for the United States had been started around, I'm not sure, about 1900, I think, at Camp Cleghorn on the Chain of Lakes. I remember as a child, my father would hitch up the Surrey and take the family down to Cleghorn several Sundays a year. And quite a few people stayed over to the meetings at Cleghorn in tents. It was a sort of vacation. I remember one time we had rented a tent there, and I remember that I had been cast to take the part. I was about 6 years old at the time, but I happened to read pretty well at that time in Welsh and English. I'd learned to read Welsh first and then in English, and I was to take the part of the pastor in a child mock wedding. But I remember when I had eaten something that, well, I had to go home by reason of ptomain poisoning, so I was unable to do that part after all. They had, at Cleghorn, a good many rather famous speakers at different times, including more including, if I remember right, the elder Robert La Follette. I remember, too, that there were other things that were spoken of by my father in the way of recollections. At the time of the Civil War, for instance, they had held a rather important, or at least a rather elaborate, Fourth of July celebration at my grandfather's home. And also there was here and there in schoolhouses and so forth, such things as wrestling matches and all that sort of thing. There was a lot of social life in those early days, but there's one difference. The people of the present day have a strong tendency to pay to be amused, and then they made their own entertainment. It is the difference between getting together with a group of your friends to play a little friendly baseball and buying a ticket to see what the Braves are going to be doing at the stadium at Milwaukee. Well, you see the Braves do better playing, no doubt, but you don't get in on the act. Well, we find, too, that in the later times, the Good Templar organization, I didn't at that earlier time know very much from the inside the organization, but later on I joined the Good Templars myself pretty largely because I saw that the organization was on the downhill, and I was quite a little concerned with the preservation of their records. I joined the organization over at Cleghorn and persuaded the group to see about the preservation of the records, which at that time were at Camp Cleghorn in a place where they were not well preserved. And with the local lodge not only approved, but elected me their delegate to the Grand Lodge of Good Templars. At that time, the Grand Lodge was having a very definite split, because in some matters that did not concern prohibition, but which did concern the ownership of certain stock that gave control of the camp at Cleghorn, which had a tax-free charter. Well, I don't know the details of that quarrel, but I do know that they had a lawsuit about it, and that at the time that I had joined, there were two factions, both factions not on speaking terms with the other, and the Vice Grand Chief Templar was dead, and under the circumstances, I, as the only neutral available, was elected Vice Grand Chief Templar, which was certainly a rather rapid rise for a young recruit. Well, I managed to persuade the two factions to agree upon sending the records to Madison, to the State Historical Society. You still have them in the files. And I remember recommending that society send acknowledgments to the leaders of both of the factions. Incidentally, the leader of one of the two factions, Mr. Millar, is now at the Bethany home of Wapaka. He's a very old man, but he could give some valuable information of his side of the story, at least in that part, in the history of the Good Templars organization. He's been very active in it and could give a lot of useful information. I remember finally the Good Templars organization decided to break up, but at least the records are now over at the Historical Society. Now, I happen to remember there are other things that might be worth remembering, miscellaneous items concerning the earlier days. I remember as a small child, sometimes Indians came through trading baskets for whatever the farmers had to sell. I remember they traded several baskets to us for a supply of salt pork. And I remember also that Oneidas came over sometimes digging potatoes. I remember a couple of Oneida boys that were working here, the first time off the reservation, the first time among pale faces, and later on they told me that they were scared stiff, first time that they were sleeping among others and other than their own people. And mother felt considerably scared. She'd been reading Indian stories too, but it wasn't long before the Indian boys and I were very good friends. Now, we, in regards to the changes in way of living, in the earlier days, the school was a matter of country school. no transportation. The schools have been located pretty largely on the basis of how far a small child can walk. I remember walking a good many times, carrying a dinner pail and probably some books, to Dopp School. And I remember the teachers in those days had some old-fashioned ideas about discipline. Well, all I have to say about it is that whether they were psychologically right or wrong, they managed to keep the delinquency problem under control pretty well, although it was rather rough on the birch trees in that vicinity, but at least it taught the fourth R. Schools are supposed to teach the three R's: reading, writing, and arithmetic. The fourth R is responsibility. In other words, one needs to know that he's got certain things that he has to do, and doing the things that you don't like is an important lesson. And incidentally, responsibility was one lesson that was learned on the farm. Farm boys have a lot less leisure than those who are not on the farm, and between hoeing potatoes, milking, and a lot of other things, there was plenty of work to be done. Of course, the matter of technology was a matter in those early days of horse-drawn equipment completely. It was usually the old walking plow. There were sulky plows and also gang plows, to be sure, but they were not so very often used. If you're sitting on a sulky and it hits a stone, you'll soon decide that you'd rather have a walking plow. And then, too, you can do better work in stony ground, perhaps, with a walking plow, but nonetheless, we had both of them. My father originally had horses of the French coach horse type, later on broncos, which incidentally needed careful handling, and the later on Percherons, fast on their feet, pulled almost as much on the bit as they did on the collar, but nonetheless, you could get a lot of work done with them. However, the idea of farming is something in itself that changed. During the 70s, there was a lot of hop raising. Hops were a good cash crop. Later on, there was a shift to wheat. I remember dimly the raising of a few acres of wheat, but wheat soon gave out in favor of the raising of potatoes. Potatoes, for a great many years, were the main cash crop, and later the shift took place to dairying. I remember in the early days the matter of taking care of milk was putting the milk in shallow pans on the shelves of an old milk safe. Later on, a water dilution cream separator came on. That is, you would put the milk in that tall, pail-like tank and then pour water in, which caused the cream to rise rather quicker, and then you'd turn after the cream had risen, and you'd see how far it had come up on the glass window in it. You'd turn the faucet and drain off the skim milk for hog feed, and then pour out the cream in the can. The earlier time that I recollect, however, was a case of selling whole milk to the Spring Rose Cheese Factory. That was located on the corner of where P enters Highway 22. The old cheese factory was pretty much of a social center to the boys, and a good many things were planned there Usually it was one of the boys of the family, in my case always myself, I having no brothers, that sometimes one of the girls of one of the families would take a road wagon and a horse and take the cans of milk down there, and the cans were unloaded, weighed, and then, after talking with some of the other youngsters around there, probably, we'd go home and go to our other chores. The cheese making, however, was finally squeezed out because that transportation problem meant too much time lost, and the creamery at Wild Rose, which made butter and which sent wagons with horses and big cans to collect cream. Now, the cream, of course, was weighed before dumping into the cans, and it was a case, too, of tests taken each time. I remember that the cheese factory went out of business, and my father, I remember, was treasurer of the cheese factory, but but no one lost much money in its closing out, so it wasn't quite a case of bankruptcy. Well, creamery later on had its problems and troubles, but general idea was that we had to turn to the to separating the cream, and after a year or two with the water dilution separator, a change was made to the cream separator. The old cream separator, with its job of washing it, was something that was in use for a good many years. But then, when the creamery started buying whole milk instead, and later on, I don't know exactly when, changed over to making of cheese, the cream separator came to be pretty much obsolete equipment. Now, in the still earlier days, according to what my father informs me, it was usual in my grandfather's time for a farmer a little before Christmas to do any butchering that he had on hand and load up a load of pork and some beef and butter, which at that time had always been homemade, and other products, and team them down to Wausau or Kronwetter and sell them to the lumber camps. There was a great deal, of work on the part of farmers with their teams in the lumber camps. But of course, most of them probably came back with their sleighs. It was the case of the roadside hotel being a very active place at times, and the man whose horses were not in good order, was very unfavorably commented upon by his neighbors. The Humane Society idea had been very strong with the Welsh group. Now, of course, this territory has gone pretty completely to dairying, but at least we'll have to consider those long, cold trips with sleighs in which they took their material to the distant market, Wausau or Kronwater, to get the product sold. Of course, potatoes was a matter of teaming down to first Plainfield and then Wild Rose after the Wild Rose Railway came in. And incidentally, I dimly, very dimly, remember the time when the railroad did come in to Wild Rose. Now, there's also the matter of how some of the lighter side of life in those days. Funny things did happen. There's one story I remember. My grandfather, according to my father, had gone to visit a neighbor, an old man who was very sick. The family lived where Potts's now live. Well, he was in bed in the kitchen, which was a well-warmed room, one of the few warm, heated rooms in the houses of that time. They had an old high oven stove there, and as his sickness had been painful, they had the bags of salt on the stove and used them, something like hot pads, to relieve the pain. But the salt bags had leaked somewhat, and his bed had salt scattered here and there, and the old stove was connected to a rather poor chimney, and it smoked quite a bit. After he got back, my grandmother asked my grandfather how the old man was, and he answered, "Indeed, I think he will last forever. Why, they're smoking and salting him already." Of course, that is only a sample of the kind of yarns that were told in those days.
Mr. Jones, the church seems to have been a very important part of the life of the Welsh in Wild Rose, and indeed in the lives of our forefathers generally. Would you care to tell us your recollections of the pastors and their training and their viewpoint?
Now, the earliest pastor that I have any recollection about, the man who did most probably to influence the community of Wild Rose in the earlier times, was Reverend Daniel Thomas. He had been not quite the original pastor, but he at least had come there within the first 4 or 5 years after the Carsalam Church had been organized. He's the earliest pastor that I remember. His education was a good one. He had a Master of Arts degree. I'm not certain as to where he had completed the work. I think it was in Ohio, though. And he preached there for well over 30 years, if I recollect correctly. And his successor there, after about a year of interregnum, of course, I don't recollect very much about that, because that Reverend Thomas had left the church in 1907. The next preacher was Reverend Ellis Roberts, and Reverend Roberts was pastor up until around 1921, and following Reverend Roberts was Reverend, I mean, it may have been, yes, I think it was 1921 that Roberts left, and following him was Reverend Davis, and then came Reverend W.T. Williams, who passed away last spring. Reverend Williams had been pastor for over 33 years, and he was active not only in church work, but also in lodge work and in community work in general, having served also for a while as a member of the school board. Now, a great deal of the development of the community is owed to Reverend W.T. Williams. Now, of course, the church is without a pastor and trying to find one. Now, I may mention, though, about the early records of the Welsh Calvinistic Methodist Church and the Welsh matters in general. It happened I was trying to get a PhD dissertation topic on Welsh matters accepted, but the University of Wisconsin and one or two other universities that I'd asked turned me down because they had no one on their faculty that was able to evaluate the work. However, there is a great deal of valuable historical material and material valuable for sociological study in the Welsh materials printed in the Welsh language, but fewer and fewer those of us who can read them. One strong source of material is a Caveant Apergeta, which would translate roughly as a biography and favorite sermons of this or that pastor. A good many were published, and they were a sort of memorial to that particular clergyman. Of course, the writers were church people rather than historians. Some important dates are left out, but they do contain a lot of valuable material, and something should be done to preserve them. The great deal of work on the Welsh has been done by the late Reverend Daniel Jenkins Williams, who had passed away a few years ago. I knew Dr. Williams personally quite well, and I know that he encouraged me in my hopes to do something about the Welsh material, and he gave me information as to where the Welsh material was to be found. He said that the two basic sources that he had used in his writings were a Cavite, which is translated as The Friend, which was the annual magazine that had been published by the Welsh Calvinistic Methodist Church, and the Messenger, I use the English word, which was the Welsh magazine published by the Welsh Congregational Church. Now, those through the Welsh churches give a pretty good idea of Welsh community life. There were, to be sure, also the Welsh Baptists. I have tried to get track of the Welsh Baptist material. I know it exists. I found a track of a book written by an old Welsh Baptist pastor in Pennsylvania, but I haven't been as yet able to find a copy of that book, nor any very strong leads about it, but at least it exists. And there was also a small Welsh Wesleyan church group. I don't know much about that. All I've been able to find about the Welsh Wesleyans was that there was one congregation of them in Winnebago County. Incidentally, I did find, in looking over the records of the old Ebenezer Baptist Church written in Welsh, now, I understand, in the custody of the Baptist Church at Wild Rose, but there are none of that congregation that can read them. I learned from that it was 1903 when the Welsh Baptist Conference, or convention, I believe they called it, was dissolved or merged in with the English-speaking one. So the change from the Welsh language to English had operated earlier in the Baptist group than in the Presbyterian or Calvinistic group. Now, I may mention also that a collection of the friend of a Cubite had belonged to Reverend Jones, who wrote poetry in Welsh under the name of Bar the Hendrib, the Bard of the Old Town. That collection was donated to the state library, to the state university library, by his widow after Dr. Jones's death. And, however, I looked over the material some years ago in the library. It was in the uncatalog section, because there was no one there able to catalog it, no one in the library staff able to read or translate Welsh. There, I found, however, that the first 12 years of the Cubite were missing, the first 12 years of the file. I did some inquiring later, and I found out from one of the other Welsh clergymen that he had, in behalf of the presbytery, looked over Dr. Jones's books, and that the first 12 years of the Cubite had been turned over to the Presbyterian denominational library over Philadelphia. So if anyone's trying to find that out, they will be able to get the information from the Presbyterian library. There are good Welsh collections of books at the Princeton University Library, at the Yale University Library, and at the Brigham Young University Library. The Welsh groups have been cooperating pretty heavily with the Brigham Young University Library, as they are trying to make particular efforts in collecting and preserving Welsh material. Some of the early Mormon settlers happened to be of Welsh extraction, incidentally. Well, we find that as far as the messenger is concerned, Dr. Williams had a good collection of that publication. I remember when I was over at his home, he showed it to me, and no doubt it has been preserved by his son. Anyone that is trying to work in Welsh materials ought by all means to consult that. I may mention also that Dr. Williams told me that he had a terrible time finding the Welsh material, that he found in many cases that his best resource was advertising for it, that the advertisement sooner or later would meet people whose ancestors at least had been Welsh, who might have something on hand. I know that in the old historical record survey days, when I was supervising the work in 10 central Wisconsin counties, I was very often asked to look over material pertaining to Welsh material, and incidentally, most of the references were to Welsh catechisms, Welsh Bibles, and Welsh biblical commentaries. I may mention, though, that in that collection of material that had went to the university library, which I understand is now in the library of the Historical Society, that there was one item of considerable interest. It was a translation into Welsh of Hamlet, which was put on at one in Welsh at one of the Welsh national Eisteddfoda. Well, the story of a Danish prince written up by a famous Englishman and presented in Welsh certainly should be interesting to an international Eisteddfod. But more important were materials of historical importance by old-time clergymen who had ridden circuit around in the Welsh community all over the United States. I have one or two of those books myself, And there's one book of the kind that there's no duplicate of in the Library of Congress that I found in connection with that collection turned over by Reverend Jones, and which I called to the attention of the librarian of the University of Wisconsin. Now that material should, by all means, be studied, and such parts as are of historical interest be translated. There is also information about the location of Welsh settlements, Welsh churches, and other things of interest to Welsh American history that can be dug out of some of these old books. Now I think that one other item of possible interest is something pertaining to the Polish settlement in the Hebron area further west in the town of Rose. Now that land through there is, to say the least, not choice from the farming point of view. The Poles, who had migrated there for about 50 or 60 years ago, had really been cheated by real estate men who sold them farms there. The land was definitely submarginal, but they had been accustomed to good land in Poland, and they didn't know that land came in that very unsatisfactory quality. Well, for the first years, they were able to get something in the way of crops, and they built a good church there at Hebron, making considerable sacrifices in order to do so, and finding that they couldn't make much of a living on their rather poor land, many of them, or members of their family at least, worked for some of the more prosperous farmers in the Welsh and the Yankee settlements around Wild Rose. As far as the Scandinavians were concerned, there were enough new Norwegians coming over so that they didn't work for the Scandinavians so often. But the Welsh settlement there were very few Welsh immigrants of the time that I remember. The Welsh settlement came from an earlier time, and most of the Welshmen owned farms and were employers rather than employees. Well, the Poles, of course, were available, and hired men were needed, so they were very often hired, and Polish girls were very often hired as hired girls. It was from a couple of Polish hired girls that I had learned as a small child to understand and speak Polish. I'm very sorry that I've forgotten it all now, incidentally. Well, it's interesting to speculate on precisely the variety of Americanization experiences that those Polish newcomers were undergoing. They were being Americanized with something of a Welsh flavor. Of course, you catch the general ideas unconsciously rather than consciously. The contact between the Welsh group and the Polish group was friendly straight through, and a good many of the Poles that set up farming were loaned money by Welshmen that they'd formerly worked for. In short, the cordial relationship between the two groups started rather early in the history of the community, and from a political point of view, you find that usually Town of Rose offices were either filled by a Welshman who had a lot of Polish votes back of him, or sometimes by a Pole that had a lot of Welsh votes back of him. I know that one former town chairman claimed that he had more Welsh votes back of him than Polish votes, and as he was very definitely Polish,
that at least spoke well for the friendly relationship between the two groups. However, from the point of view of intermarriage, the situation has been quite different because the Poles are very definitely and very faithfully Catholic, and the Welsh have been just as definitely and just as strongly Protestant, and the clergy of both very properly and very thoroughly disapprove intermarriage. I know of two cases where the where girls of the Polish group had married outside of their group, one into the Welsh group and the other into the Scandinavian group, and both of those marriages did not turn out well. But however, the two groups have been able to work together as good friends, but very definitely not as in-laws.
What about the Welsh relations with other groups, other than the Poles, other groups in Washara County?
The Welsh relation with the Scandinavian group that has I recollect has been one about what one could expect. The Norwegians, as a group, are a desirable group, nice people, but they very definitely do not change their ways rather readily. There, up until about 15 or 20 years ago, there wasn't very much intermarriage of the Norwegian group compared to the so-called pure marriages within the Norwegian group. But lately, there has been a great deal of intermarriage between the Norwegian group and the Welsh group. I believe that the younger classes of the Sunday school are at least two shades blonder than they were when I attended the younger classes of the Sunday school. The Norwegian group certainly has been contributing a lot to the Welsh, or rather I should say to the Presbyterian Church, because the group is now very definitely Presbyterian, and while they happen to be a Welsh extraction, not all of them are a Welsh extraction. Quite a few others who have joined also, and it is a case of the Welsh group merging into the American population as a whole, but still hanging on to some of their Welsh characteristics. One of those characteristics is a fondness for music. I know that you can find people of Welsh extraction from all over the state at the Welsh song festivals. Gamanva Gani is the name applied to them in Welsh, that are held at Pickett and at sometimes at Cambria and sometimes at other places in this state. And there's some great singing there. And I notice, incidentally, that quite a few of the voices there have, of recent years, had some trouble with the characteristic Welsh guttural sounds, and I have a strong suspicion that a few sing with a slightly German accent. I noticed that the German Sängerfest people are taking an interest in the Welsh song festivals, and as far as that goes, they have a strong interest in common. Both peoples are interested in music, and I have a feeling that eventually the program will become a generalized American program. In fact, the Welsh song festivals, though, are of two types. There is the Gamanva Gani, or song festival, which is devoted pretty largely to the use of sacred music. It differs from the German Sängerfest in that the Sängerfest makes use of folk music more than hymn music. And there's also the Eisteddfod. The Eisteddfod is literally the seating, because that the winner of the first prize is seated in the silver chair. That is the equivalent of a first place. Well, there it is a contest rather than a festival. There's definite placing there. There are different choirs appearing, one in competition with the other, and there are items other than singing also. For instance, in the Welsh International Eisteddfod at Llangollen, there was quite a little regret of recent a couple of years ago, because that the Czech folk dancing group were unable to get out from the other side of the Iron Curtain to attend it. Well, the general thought is, however, that the Eisteddfod, while it still exists, is not as strong as it was. But the Gamanvagani program is stronger than ever and becoming stronger. Incidentally, at the end of this month, they're going to have the American National Gamanvagani Convention meeting at Milwaukee. It's a worthwhile item. I was present at the National Gamanvagani program at Milwaukee a few years ago. I remember the group was one that sang with a great deal of enthusiasm. They were the sort of people that keep on singing when they were reaching for their hats and putting on their coats. I remember after the meeting, the group assembled, at least about 600 of them, in the lobbies and along the stairway of one of the largest hotels of Milwaukee, and went on singing. I remember about 1 or 1:30 a.m. that a few of the Milwaukee police came in to see what was going on, and I noticed they had some very good tenor voices among them. They were singing with the rest of the group before long. After all, you can't criticize anyone for singing hymn music. It's a worthwhile activity. And I may mention that the Eisteddfod has had influence on the American high school program for this reason. In the early about 1915 to 1920 or thereabouts, they had a strong Welsh Eisteddfod over at Kansas City. And some of the teachers of the high school had taken it in, and they adapted the program to a music festival for the high school, and that program caught on. The American high school music programs are to a great extent simply an adaptation of the Welsh Eisteddfod.